Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome back. This conversation is with Dame Commander Heather Rabatz, who's had an incredible career. Check this out. She's been a barrister, a BBC governor, the youngest ever chief executive of both Merton and Lambeth councils, a boss at Channel 4, a director of the Bank of England. She was the first woman to be appointed a director of the FA and was also chief executive of none other than Millwall FC. And all this from a woman who certainly did not do well at school. Heather is full of lessons, insight and wisdom, and I hope you enjoy listening. Morning, Heather.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Yes, a bit tired. It was an early start, but you know, that's most of my days are early starts.
Absolutely. Well, so we spoke on the phone a couple of days ago in prep for this, and you were talking about that you were spinning plates at the time. I mean, that's the story of your life, isn't it?
It is pretty much spinning plates, some of them crashing down around me and thinking, I'm not sure I can fix that plate anymore. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, as with many people, we juggle complicated lives. But for me, I have loved the sort of range and diversity of my working day.
Now, you are a Dame Commander, right?
I am. I am a Dame Commander. Practice your curtsy now.
I should have done, really. Yeah. I've had a few dames on, but you, so that, I think, that makes you the loftiest that's been on here.
Oh, well.
So, I'm privileged.
I have to say, I always felt the name Dame was sort of complicated because it reminds me of pantomime parts, you know, and whether I would be the back end of the widowed Twenky's horse or whatever it might be. But it was a real honour, and I think obviously it was for services to football and diversity and equality, and you know, those challenges we know remain as large today as ever. So it's a recognition of the work that I, but countless others, do in that space.
If you, as a young girl, let's say 10-year-old, well, no, let's say 11-year-old, because you failed your 11 class.
Yes, I'm sadly that old.
If the 11-year-old you was told that she would go on to become a Dame Commander, would she have believed you?
No chance. No absolute chance. I mean, I was, you know, my mother was Jamaican and my father English, mixed race, pretty much a total white school, felt, you know, on the outside, didn't do well at school, hence I failed my 11 plus. And, you know, the future for then, you know, when you failed your 11 plus was very bleak. You weren't going to go and do anything. You weren't going to achieve anything. I suppose if I knew anything, it was, and this was definitely linked to both my mum and also my dad, was I refused to be sort of written off at 11. I watched lots of other kids who were really talented being written off, but I somehow managed to hold on to a belief that that was not going to be my destiny. What it was, how it would pan out, of course, no, you just don't know, but it was just no, this is not good. I won't be put into that box.
It's interesting because people do get labelled, and I've spoken to a couple of other people who've mentioned this about being labelled and how destructive that can be. Mm. And like you said, people do get written off, and then it's quite easy to internalise that. So how did you not let that hold you back?
It's a very difficult question to answer because it comes from within yourself. I think at that point, your parents, are massively important in giving you that sense of A, love, but B, my mum, who'd been engaged in the civil rights movement, whose family can trace the slave ships that brought them to Jamaica, was, in her own way, just absolutely, you do not, she used to say to me, you either lie down and die or you get up and fight. So just get up, girl, just get up. And that's what I just keep doing. I get up.
I tell you, you've got some cracking quotes. That's another one. I've written a few down, but this is a new one to add to the list.
Well, my mum had a whole panoply of them, some of which I won't go into on the radio, but she didn't think I was doing things I should be doing.
So what were your parents' reaction then when you did fail your 11 plus?
Oh, they were really upset. They were very, they both believe passionately in education. And they knew what it meant. The education is the great, opens the door, and suddenly doors were closing all around me. It didn't stop them being supportive, but they knew it was a significant moment in my life. And I think that's why they were even more, particularly my mum, forthright around, getting up and just moving forward.
You've spoken about how your dad always sort of, was very supportive and backing of you.
Yeah.
And for you to fail the 11+, and also, you had a rough time at school, didn't you? Because obviously with your background and your heritage, you stood out.
Yeah.
And people, as we know, kids can be cruel, can't they?
They definitely can be cruel, yes. And I think the experience of being bullied is sadly something that happens to millions of young people. And it was before you had anti-bullying policies in schools and all of that. But I think it was just feeling that, my mum and dad were doing all they could to try and create a safe harbour. And I don't know what it was that was within me that enabled me ultimately to stand the ground. But those experiences are so formative. You never lose them. You can instantly be taken back to the playground or the failing of the 11+. And it is the memory of that, I think, that also still gives me the sort of strength to start the next day, because there are always challenges. They don't go away, even though one gets slightly older and I hope wiser. But
there are lots of very successful people that spring to mind who refer to one incident in their childhood or whatever, where perhaps a teacher has said you won't amount to anything. To what degree then is your schooling experience fueled your drive?
Massively so. And I think it's quite an interesting shared characteristics of people who are in quotes called leaders, which is that they've often had that formative moment where something turned for them. And I think, some of the most effective leaders have used those moments of experience of being bullied or insecurity and turned it into a real source of resilience. And I think that for me, it has been absolutely what I've tried to do through my life.
So that kind of adversity making you or breaking you, do you think that is a choice?
It's not a simple choice. It's work. You work on it. You have to work on it the whole time. Because there are moments where, as I said, you get taken back to the playground and your fear and your insecurity sort of arising in the back of your throat. And it's about how do you sort of regroup in the moment so that you can not give in to that, like, oh, I'm so scared, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to say. And I talk a lot about, people say, well, you're fearless. I go, no, I'm scared a lot of the time. But it's about turning that fear into a different source of energy.
we can all relate to that, being taken back to, yeah, you know, painful childhood memories. We've all kind of got them, and having trigger points, essentially. So then, okay, as someone then who clearly, you know, will feel the fear, I suppose, and do it anyway then. So when those moments do come up in your present life or recent life, how do you cope with it? Like, what do you do?
I think at the time it's sort of instinctive, and it's slightly acting at a subconscious level. What you're aware of is the discomfort. What you're aware of is, oh, gosh, I'm not sure how to handle this situation. Somebody's just said something, or what I thought was going to happen is now not happening. And you can feel that sort of, oh, gut-wrenching tension. Yes, I think it's just about sort of, I just think you have to just hold it together. So yesterday, for example, I got a very difficult piece of news around a film I'm involved in before I was chairing a theatre board meeting. And I was just in a sort of state of shock. But the fact that I had to go into that meeting 2 minutes later meant I had to sort of marshal myself. And I think that's what... And by doing that, you can go back to thinking about that crisis in a different way.
Yeah. So, it's okay, marshalling yourself. And I guess, you know, each time you do that, it becomes easier the next time.
Yes. I mean, you know, so as I said, you know, there are many times, you know, it happens without conscious thought. Sometimes you have to really work it through in the moment.
You talk about a safe harbour. And so we've spoken about your drive coming through, at least in part, some of your tough experiences. As well, though, how important was that safe harbour in enabling you to go on and become a Dame Commander?
I think safe harbours are hugely important, and safe harbours are, I think, your friends, your family, your home, and knowing that somewhere there is this place where you are loved and you love other people. And I think I've always, not always successfully, mind you, try to hold on to that. You know, I am a very driven person. I am somebody who has wanted to do difficult things for all sorts of weird and wonderful reasons. And I, you know, am probably a bit of a workaholic, you know, and that's my way of probably dealing with all sorts of issues that are still lurking beneath. And, you know, you to work and to be driven brings great rewards, but there's also a price to be paid. And I think it's about understanding the choices that you're making, and that they're not easy choices.
You talk about being a workaholic and having issues in there. Now, we've all got issues, haven't we?
We've all got issues, yes.
Everybody. Everyone has issues. There's no doubt about that. How important is it to be aware of them, and how important is it to actually work on them?
I think really important. Really important. And believe you me, I have not cracked this at all.
No one has.
Nobody has. No. I think it's about having insight. It's about thinking about what happened, either in a meeting or in a board discussion, about your behaviour. And was there something that went on there that was triggered by one of those memories? Or did you conduct yourself in the way that you really fundamentally believe in? Did you let yourself down? And I think having that insight, and also really trying to hear feedback from other people, which I don't find easy. Yeah. I can get very defensive.
Of course. None of us do. You get that feeling again.
And I have somebody who's worked with me, I can't begin to say it, for a huge number of years. And he does give me that feedback, because I'm sort of known as I can be a bit scary. I'm still surprised by that. I used to be told that men had often went to the toilet before they came to see me, which I thought, really? But for anybody, I think really listening to feedback, you only get to deal with those issues if you hear the feedback, and you've got to stay open to that.
Yeah. I've, again, spoken to various people, and something that's come up is the idea of, as well, self-questioning.
Yeah.
As opposed to being self-critical. Are you able to steer that path?
I think, well, sometimes I tip over into being more self-critical. But I try to be self-questioning.
Do you think women are more open to accepting their issues and working on them than men? I don't like to generalise.
No, I think what we as women are better at than men is sharing it with others. I think we feel, on the whole, most women I know will talk, as I am now with you, but also with each other about that. I think for men, historically, it has been harder. I think what's been really brilliant in recent times, for example, in the whole mental health campaign, is men standing up and saying they've had mental health issues and opening up that whole, very successful people talking about those vulnerabilities, which we've all had at times. And I think, I hope that that sort of is slightly resetting the sort of ability of all of us to talk about, you know, our fears and hopes. Yeah. I mean, whenever I've managed people, I always say it's not to do with all those weird and wonderful management books, which I can't be doing with most of the time. It is about understanding that people bring their hopes and fears and insecurities into work and how they are managed and supported and motivated has to take cognizance of that human spirit.
Yeah. We all need examples of to show us what is possible. And that includes men opening up and speaking out, doesn't it? Because it's easy to say, oh, men are, you know, don't deal with this as well. And I guess I alluded to that slightly in the question. But actually, if culturally or historically that isn't the case, well, then inevitably men will struggle. And we pay a price for that.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, it is about how we learn. It is about how we learn. And that's why when people like Rio Ferdinand stood up, for millions of people, that was really significant, and men, was very significant, that he opened himself up to that level of vulnerability. And that took real courage. That takes real courage. And I thought that was, they are markers in the journey that we are all on about how we, you know, how we learn about ourselves and hopefully how we get better.
Yeah. Vulnerability, as you said there, I mean, absolutely key words. I mean, so you're in here,
yeah,
very successful, but then here we are within 10 minutes talking about having issues.
Right? Yeah.
And that vulnerability, there's a huge strength in vulnerability and owning one's shadow side.
Yes, I think so. I think it's also, it's about knowing that in terms of how you conduct yourself, in terms of leadership, in terms of all the things that I do, it is about understanding that level of vulnerability, but also about having the confidence to, you know, go forward and to hopefully bring people together and help catalyse change or whatever it might be, the nature of one of the plates that I'm spinning. Because you can't sit in the corner and be going, oh, I feel terribly vulnerable today and I'm not sure I can speak. Mm. It is about, okay, yeah, I am feeling vulnerable, but listen, we got to deal with this. We got to get on with this. And whether that's running a business or whether that's being involved in a theatre or football where you're trying to press for change, yeah, that's what you have to do. And also, I think it's that recognition that you mentioned, which is, so everybody feels vulnerable. So once you realise everybody's feeling vulnerable, and even though you're, you know, you're facing captains of industry or whatever it might be, then it's much easier. You feel suddenly you're on an equal footing.
I remember going to actually a launch party, and invariably everyone's, you know, one feels sort of a bit anxious. And then I think, but telling yourself, hang on, everyone feels like this.
Everybody feels like
this. And then that takes a lot of pressure off immediately.
It does.
Right, just back to the safe harbour. You shared a bedroom with your sister for years and years and years, and you're still tight as anything, aren't you?
Yeah.
That must be very strength giving.
I think, yeah, it has been. And we're very different people. But as we've both got older, I think we've got closer. And that's, again, it goes back to family. It's because, of course, you share that memory of that journey. And it was tough for her and it was tough for me. And we both know that in a way that nobody else does.
Mm. Is she as driven as you?
No. I think she looks at me and goes, why do you want to live like that? Yeah. Why do you want to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and finish late at night? Yeah. And she's got a point. She's got a point. Yeah. But it is, we are, that's what I mean, we are very different. Yeah. But, you know, and you I don't know what it was in me that just said, I won't lie down, but that has just been my mantra, really.
Another one. Crikey. Honestly, you've got a book of them. Right, final word on safe harbour before we get into, you know, your career. Mm. If you had to think of kind of the key elements to building a safe harbour or having one, what springs to mind?
I think it's trying to ensure that there is a place where you can express your fears and anxieties, and that you're not going to be judged in that moment. That's what a safe harbour is, that you can strip yourself bare and you'll still be loved. And there are very few places you do that, and you don't always succeed in doing that. But I think that's what a safe harbour is. And, you know, I try with my family to convey a sense of, you know, whatever happens, you know, I always will unconditionally love you.
Yeah. And how important is it to say, to vocalise that?
I think it's really important.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we forget.
Yeah. Yeah.
As we get older, you know, it's my son's in his, I'm not going to say how old he is, but he's a father of a lovely, my granddaughter. And yeah, he's been hugely important to me.
Right. So there you were, left school at 16. Mm-hmm. Teacher said you were at best going to work in a shop. Trained as a barrister, but you made your name as the youngest local authority chief executive, right?
Yeah.
So what? How did you go from leaving at 16 to doing that?
Who knows?
I mean, was there a rocket somewhere in the middle there? Like,
No, there wasn't. I suppose there was. I loved being a barrister, but it was very tricky with a young son. So I sort of fell into the public sector, because it was, you could work, pick up your kids from the nursery and all those things. And I was really interested in public policy. You know, when you're dealing as a barrister, you're dealing in the moment of crisis in people's lives. You think, well, are there ways in which that crisis could have been mitigated if that young mother had access to decent housing or whatever it might be? So I fell into local government and just found I could swim in organisations and I just loved it and I could do it. And people said, oh, you're quite good at this. And so I was very fortunate. I was promoted. I was given more responsibility. And then I applied for a chief exec role. I became, I think I was 32, the youngest chief exec.
Wow.
In the country. Yeah. And then you think, oh, God. What do I always remember walking in the first day. It was the London Borough of Merton, where, in fact, Theresa May was my deputy leader of the Conservatives, who was formidable then, actually. I remember walking in and the security guard said, good morning, chief. And I thought I had a military person behind me. And I looked behind me and there was nobody. And he said, good morning, chief. Are you talking to me? And he said, yes. And it was like terror. And I said, no, my name's Heather. What's your name? I can still remember it now. Yeah. That Terry was his name. And I said, no. I said, you know, it's sort of like first day at school, isn't it? A bit scary. You know, my office was on the 18th floor of some tower block or something. And I remember then one of my four assistant chief execs come to see me saying, well, Mom, I really don't think you should let the security people, you know, call you Heather, because it will diminish the respect, particularly as you're so young. I thought he's trying to get on the good side of me. I said, no, I'm Heather. And I realised, of course, if I was Heather, then he couldn't be called. I think he was called some ridiculous name, sir, or something. And I remember going on around this cultural change and how, you know, you have to look about people are valued not for their places in hierarchy, but for what they can contribute. And ultimately, you know, he left the organisation. And his final day, he came to see me. He said, well, Mom, you know, the best of luck. So my cultural change programme failed with him.
Yeah. It shows then that it's important to stick to your guns. And that's impressive that you resisted that, I guess. So sticking to your guns was obviously then a key element in your success.
I think if, you know, I've led various different organisations. One of the points I often make when talking about leadership is about authenticity, that you have to have a moral compass. And for me, that goes back to where I started, you know, respect, values, valuing other people and what they have to contribute and what they have to say. And now, I'm not saying I was perfect at it, and then probably people were saying, actually, she was awful, we didn't like her. But that's what you have to hold on to. And I knew that it was really important. If you're going to start to get people to work in different ways, then I absolutely don't believe in command and control.
No. I had Sam Warburton, Lions and Wales captain, on, and he said the first thing, the kind of first lesson was, like, know who you are to be successful in sport. And clearly, to be successful in life,
You have to know who you are. I think knowing who you are and staying true to yourself is what gives you the sort of anchoring when the storms, and there are always storm clouds, gather, and sort of hold you feet, you know, to the ground. And, you know, I've watched people who don't have that, and that you unravel.
You come untethered. So, and knowing who you are, now it's all, it can almost sound a little cliche, but that, I get, so to me that means, yeah, your values. What's important,
yeah,
who's important, what your beliefs are. Yeah. It's the same to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those values you try and always abide by in whatever walk of life you're involved in.
So it's very important to actually establish what your values are, because a lot of people don't know.
Well, no, I think that's true. And that's why I think knowing your values, knowing who you are, is fundamental. Both to, I think, enjoying and living your life. Yeah. But if you're placed with the responsibility of leadership, hugely so.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got three key things. We've got safe harbour, knowing who you are, and looking to own and grow through your issues. Right, those are three thus far.
Okay.
That's not a bad little compass to keep one on track.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
So you talk about you're good at swimming in organisations. Mm. And, you know, who doesn't want a promotion, right?
Yeah.
And obviously you got pretty blooming good at it to rise to the very top at 32. And some people are better within organisations than others. What do you think are the key elements then to succeeding, you know, organisations that are often very bureaucratic?
Oh, gosh, that's a whole hour in itself, really. I think it's about how you build legions of interest, how you share a consensus about the direction of travel and how you build that so that everybody thinks, OK, we know where we need to go to. But actually you give people sufficient room for manoeuvre and you empower them so that the way they get there is also their own way. Now, that is really, it is not easy. It's really complicated. And there's, you know, there are lots of restraints, obviously, if you're in public organisations. But I think it was trying to figure that space out that I've spent a long time in. And that for me was why I felt that we could make things happen in quite complicated environments.
Well, you distilled an hour's talk. Well, very well done. So Merton, walk in the park, essentially, right, compared to Lambeth, which was described as the worst job in local government. So, I mean, you're a glutton for punishment in many ways. And so what... It was literally advertised as the worst.
It was.
I mean, that's a...
And it was.
A clever advert.
It was a very clever advert, and it was true.
So what, you just thought, I want as big a challenge as possible?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I just... I could give you another quote. I feel like this man could become...
I'm becoming a
sort of cliche here.
No, that's fine. I love it.
Which is, it's better to live one day as a tiger than 100 days as a sheep. And I sort of think, that's right. So... But also, the great thing about Lambeth was that, you know, the town hall is in Brixton. And Brixton is the black soul of this country in many ways. And, of course, had been a place of black protest. Uh-huh. And therefore, I actually felt really at home in Lambeth. I mean, the challenges were huge. I mean, beyond I could have imagined. But, you know, in every organisation... there are wonderful people, and it's just about finding them. And, you know, there was some, I worked with some amazing counsellors, with people who'd been in Lambeth for years, who had quietly tried to cope within chaos. And I think, you know, over those 5 years, it was about the collective efforts of many people. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it, but my gosh, it burnt me out by the end of that time, yeah.
How long were you there?
5 years. I did my, you know, I had a 5-year term, and I said by the end of it, you know, we'll be out of the worst performance leagues, and we will have, I think one of my proudest moments was ensuring we got a clean audit on the pension fund because it'd been raided in the past. I mean, how exciting is that? But it was a really important time in my life. It was incredible. People worked enormous hours to try and make the changes that the people and the residents of Lambeth deserved.
So did you have a vision in your head then of what you needed to achieve and how you would achieve it and just kept that at the forefront of your mind for the whole of that 5 years?
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
So you can't bounce around from one thing to the next.
No, it's about, and that's one of the challenge. I mean, of course, you get bounced around by events.
Yes, of course.
But I think what we tried to do is to say there was a direction of travel that you shared with, you know, managers, the sort of senior directors, work through with them, and you tried to sort of hold that as a guiding path in your head the whole time.
I read a lovely story about when Nelson Mandela came to Lambeth. Oh, yeah. And what a fantastic example. Oh. So he stepped out and did a bit, I mean, a little like you did when you were called chief and you're like, no, I have none of that. But can you just tell us what he did? And I think this speaks to the power, the immense power of humility.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, well, one of my abiding treasured memories is Mandela coming to Brixton, and he came with Prince Charles. And, you know, you can imagine all of the protocols. And actually, Prince Charles was just incredible. He just stood back the whole time. And there were two things. Oh, gosh, there were so many things that struck me about Mandela. He had a very young white main bodyguard. And he thought, oh, OK, that's interesting. He comes out of the car. You realise how frail he is, his knees, and that people just wanted to touch him. It was like, you know, the Messiah. They just wanted to touch him. And he talks absolutely, and he says to the security guard, what's your name? And you can see the guard is just, he's virtually speechless. He's, and that, it was this great sense of humanity. And this young bodyguard, I think his name was Rory, just very gently protects him from literally people wanting just to touch him. And I heard the story that when he was getting up to leave the hotel, he would go and talk to all the staff, because the staff in hotels at 5 o'clock in the morning are usually the black shift. And you just, you were humbled yourself just to stand next to him. He was just, it brings tears to my eyes now.
Yeah, I mean, just talking about him, there's a power even just in the kind of the name Mandela,
isn't there? Yeah, I mean, there was a Zulu name for him, which I can't now recall, but it's the man who casts a long shadow. And my gosh, you know, what what a man. And sadly, we live in a time where the quality of that leadership that he had and that humility is not apparent in many of our current leaders.
Oh, yes.
Sadly.
And to make a beeline for the people who are the bottom or towards the bottom of the social chain, as an example, I mean, that's really
incredible. It was just, and he didn't, it wasn't an act. It wasn't something that he thought, well, this is a good thing to do. It was him. Yeah. It was absolutely him, and it had been him all of his life. And whether you read, when you read the book, his relationship with his jailers, it's absolutely all there. And you think when he was subject to such a brutal regime, to not resort to vengeance, to not resort to a use of violent language, to actually always stay humble. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody learn. Everybody should learn from that.
Absolutely. To be humble, it's easy to lose sight of that when you become more successful.
Totally. But it's also the combination. I mean, this was a man so strong in his spirit. You know, so it's that unbelievable sort of combination of strength and vulnerability and humility.
Oh, yes.
And that is absolutely what Mandela personified, and that's why he reached millions of people around the world, and they were touched by him. Even when they just, you know, when they, you know, when they released him from prison, when they heard him talk, when they went to the Rugby World Cup,
absolutely.
You know, that moment is like, it is awesome. It is absolutely awesome, and I hope that memory of him and how it should inspire all of us.
Yes, that's one almost that's gone into my top five favorite quotes. The mixture of strength and vulnerability, absolutely key. So you knocked off your worst job in local government, worst job in football. I mean, so
Millwall.
Crikey, O'Reilly. Yes. So what? But this, this is somewhere that actually gave you the most satisfaction.
Well, I think, you know, Lambeth gave me lots of satisfaction. I think, you know, roles give you different things. You know, if Lambeth, one of the big parts of Lambeth was going to Brixton and, you know, feeling in some ways more at home. Millwall, my dad came from Bermondsey. He came from that part of London. So there was something about, I suppose, going back to a different part of my heritage. And that's what I mean about, you know, every organisation has wonderful people. Nowhere is beyond redemption, in my view. And Millwall had this, yes, and has some challenging fans. It does, as do, sadly, other football clubs. And that has to be absolutely forcefully tackled. But it also has fantastic fans. The people who I work with at Millwall, it was a family. And if I'd said to my head of security, a fantastic guy, Colin, could you just walk over those hot coals for me? He just would have done it. Because everybody was wanting the club to succeed. And I had never, in a way, I was embraced in Millwall in a way that I was sort of totally surprised by. As this mixed race woman, I remember meeting the fans, and one of my security people saying, "Well, this could get a bit tricky." I go, "No, it'll be fine." And one of the fans stood up, who, you know, was pretty, you know, in your mind you think that's a Millwall fan, but actually they are rich and diverse. He said, "Well, are you a Millwall fan? Are you a Millwall supporter?" And I said, "No, I'm an Arsenal girl." Well, you can imagine. You know, it was 700, I think, fans there, mainly white men. And they said, "Well," I said, "Look, you haven't employed me because I'm a fan. You've employed me to try and get this club out of the deep position, you know, I don't know if I can say that word on the radio.
You can.
But, yeah,
it's a podcast.
It's a podcast in the deep shit it is in. You know, it's struggling in League One. We're in, you know, serious trouble. And so that's what you've employed me to do. And my task is to do two things, is to try and bring in a refinance the club and, you know, and ensure that this club is promoted. Now, that will happen because a whole series of things and other people need to be doing their jobs. That's my commitment. And, yeah, and that's... We went and, you know, we went, you know, but that my last days were great to see Millwall promoted to the Championship.
So by standing your ground in that moment and speaking truthfully, did you win them over?
Totally. So, well, not totally, well, but yeah, man, no, but absolutely, no, no, because one of the things is you should never lie. If I'd said, yeah, I've always been a secret Millwall supporter, no way they would have said so. So who is the captain, all that stuff. You go, no, so you just don't lie. Don't pretend to be something you're not, because you will. People are instinctive.
Yeah.
You know, it's like television audiences. People who try and fake things, the audiences just know. They go, that's the
thing. You can sniff it.
We absolutely can. There's something about us as human beings. We go, no, I'm not really sure about that. So I always say, women might say, well, how should I be at a board or, you know, when I'm turning up in my first day? I said, you just got to be yourself, because if you do anything else, it will become impossible. So just don't lie. Even though there was this moment, I could feel my security guy getting a bit closer to me. I said, that'll be fine.
So your experience at Millwall, a couple of things that struck me there. Yeah. First of all, again, like the danger of labels. Mm. You know, it's easy to label Millwall in a certain way, but as you say, there are good people everywhere. Yeah. So, you know, this inclination that we have to lay on a label to a person or a group of people or a club.
Yeah.
Always a bad idea.
Always a bad idea. Now, are there issues at Millwall around some fans that clearly do not behave in a way that any of us think is appropriate? Yes. Are there fans at Chelsea who do that? There's just been at West Ham a fan banned for life for a racist video. This happens. It happens because football does not exist in a vacuum. It is operating in a world, sadly, where we know that those views are held by many people. And football has to just stand up and make a stand against it.
Mm. You're the first woman director of the FA. And something that I find very interesting is you said you weren't even hugely into football before your experiences in the game, and that would put a lot of people off.
Yeah, so a couple of things around becoming the first woman in 150 years to be on the board of the FA is, I think, and I had run a football club, I had dealt with media rights, I actually had quite a lot of experience. And, you know, the classic for most women is if they don't tick every box in a job description, they don't apply, whereas, you know, men will tick two and they will go for it. And women will go, oh, I can't do that because I can't, you know, make the tea or whatever it might
be. Not all men, because we're not doing labels.
Well, we're not doing labels. A lot of men. Okay. I could tell you the story. I'll tell you this one brief story. Yeah, which is when I was at Millwall, I decided that we would go, you know, we'd run a process to recruit our new manager. And we got all these applications, and I got these applications saying, you know, I have got Accrington Stanley through to the Champions League final against Real Madrid. Now, my knowledge of football is patchy, although my sons are Arsenal fans and, you know, a regular and season ticket holders and have been going since they were 2 years old or whatever. I thought, no, I don't believe that. And you realise that they had been playing FIFA Football Manager, and they thought this just qualified them to go for manager jobs. Now, I thought, well, we were a lower league club. I talked to some of my colleagues in the Premier League and said, oh, no, we get the same. So, no, I'm not putting men in a label at all. So I did have experience, but yes, you're still walking into an environment where there were others who were steeped in knowledge, deep knowledge about the game.
So it's not being put off by, okay.
No,
it's again easy to be self-defeating.
Well, and also I think it's about the recognition of transferability of skills.
Okay, that's good.
And I think that's really, so that, you know, I don't, you know, because you've been in this silo means you can't be in that position over there. Whereas actually, knowing how you build alliances, knowing how you craft, you know, a sort of sense of travel. So whether that was about trying to get more black coaches in the game or whatever it might be, how we look to, you know, clearly improve the quality of support going into both the men and the women's England teams. You do that because you're working with other people and you're trying to find out where they're coming from and where you're coming from. Now, all of that is what you go back to swimming in organisations. That's what you have to do because, you know, another quote, no one person changes the world. It's how together we change the world for one person.
Love it.
Right?
Love
so
it.
You just don't do stuff by yourself. And I think that's what I understood. It was about how do we build alliances, and particularly in football, where you have to have an alliance between the clubs, the leagues, the Football Association, UEFA and FIFA. It is, you know, it is by all of those people coming together and saying this is how we need to change what we do, whether you're trying to talk about tackling racism, whether you're talking about the introduction of video technology, you only get it to work. And that's why it takes time and it's quite difficult and painful, by putting all those building blocks together.
Again, this is probably an hour's lecture, and you may have already touched on it. So building alliances, what's the key? Is it, again, having a vision and sweeping people along with it?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, it's how do you get stuff done? I mean, you think, well, to get this to be implemented, and I'm interested in ideas, but I'm interested in action. To get it implemented, who needs to do that? Who needs to get that to happen? Well, that requires the league or the clubs or the football authorities or the regulators. That's how it happens. So to do that, you've got to work with those people, and hopefully they share, and you talk and you build that consensus about sharing that direction of travel. Now, I'm not saying it's all done in sort of nicey-nicey way. At times you have to be, I suppose I go back to standing the ground. You know, from my perspective is, I suppose when I speak, I can speak with a sense of authority because, you know, I'm now quite an older person. I've got all these years. But it is about how you hold a room and you say, we now have to do this. We absolutely have to bring about this change. We cannot have a game that is diverse on the field and white on the benches. We cannot have that. Now, we all have to work together to make that change happen. Now, the progress is slow, but there is some progress. You know, people like Chris Powell have just gone into Gareth Southgate's team. Michael Jackson's just joined the under-21s. You know, in terms of embedding black coaches across the coaching structure, which is one of the things I worked on when I was at the FA, and the person who took up the leadership, Paul Elliott, fantastic Chelsea player whose career was cut short by an injury, has been continuing that work. And that's what I mean about alliances. Alliances are not only with the people who are sitting around that table at that time, it's also about trying to ensure you've knitted together alliances that will stay when you've left the room.
So communication skills are clearly vital.
Yeah. If you can't communicate what you're trying to do, you might as well, but that's not very good.
Right, now listen, we're slightly running out of time and we've only done about a couple of dozen of your quotes, so I want to get in a few more.
No, I've done far too many. I am becoming a walking cliche.
I love them. I love a blooming quote. So, okay, so you always need your own nick of money.
Yeah. So my mum was Jamaican and she worked before she came over here and didn't work when she came into this country, and felt very, therefore, her independence was absolutely confined by not being able to, you know, to buy her own knickers. And so she used to say, whatever happens, always have your own knicker money. So part of my career has been about having sufficient financial independence always.
Don't expect someone else to ever look after you. Always be ready to step up. And
it'd be nice if somebody did occasionally, but no, exactly.
Okay. Life is to be lived, and you've always enjoyed standing on the edge and taking risks. Now, I've really come to realise this, you know, the importance of risk-taking in life. But you want to take risks without being reckless.
Well, first of all, I think you have to find your own path. And taking risks is very uncomfortable. So it isn't for the faint-hearted. I think the other thing is about, what are you taking risks for? Are you taking risks just to be on a joyride? Or are you taking risks because you think you can do something? I suppose, you know, my other value is, how do you make a difference? How do you make a difference? What is your contribution? What's the footprint you're trying to leave in the sand before it all washes over you when you're pushing up the daisies or whatever it might be? And I think, so for me, the taking of risks has been about that. There is another say that an old chief exec, Max Dupre, who said, you only learn when you're at risk. And I suppose I have, you know, and maybe it goes back to failing the 11 plus. I just want to keep learning. And that's why I keep doing things that are in different spaces, because I go, okay, I've never been quite here, but I think there's something that I can contribute and I want to learn about here. doesn't always work out. You know, I have failed. I mean, you probably learn that again, you know, as we all know, we learn more from our failures than we do our successes. But I do, I think you have to ask yourself, you know, are you the sort of person who wants to take risks? And what are the boundaries to those risks? You know, I was talking to a woman yesterday who's got three kids, one disabled, and was saying, you know, I've been 20 years in the same place. I want to be somewhere different. I said, but you need the security. You're the main breadwinner because your partner's taking care of your disabled daughter. So how... OK, so we came up with a bit of a plan about maybe taking a day less and working on how she can broaden her skill set. So she is taking a risk, but it's mitigated because she's got responsibilities. Now, that's what I mean about, you know, so it's not about taking risks. Hey-ho, nothing matters because we all have responsibilities, whether it's families and friends and mortgages and all of those things. But it is about saying, I suppose it's, you know, on the day of reckoning, when you look back, do you think, well, I lived a life?
Right. Okay.
Right. Right. Okay.
Okay. Here we go, Heather. Right. So no, I got you on.
Yeah.
Let me see if I've got any quotes. Anyway. So I got you on, but basically, because the thread running through your life is doing the difficult thing and embracing difficult challenges. So in terms of doing the difficult thing, what would be your words of wisdom on that?
It's about doing the difficult thing because it has some purpose. It's not just doing the difficult thing. Oh, that's a bit tough, you know. I can't do a Rubik's Cube, you know. I think it's about, you know, when I went to Lambeth, it was absolutely about this place can be and should be different. You know, whether it's the, you know, whether it's the work in the FA about trying to support diversity across the game, whether it was working with Eva Canero when she stood up against being bullied in the way that she was. I think, and that we come back always to your safe harbour, to your values. So it isn't about just doing the difficult thing for the sake of it being difficult. It is about doing the difficult thing because I suppose I have the belief in myself that I can help to make that difference. And I can't do it by myself. I have to do it with other people. But that's what I think has been my guiding light. And I, you know, I go back to my parents who said, you know, well, what are you going to do with your life? What's going to give it meaning? And, you know, it was never about my bank balance, sadly, but it was about feeling that you could do things that hopefully makes a bit of a difference. And, you know, there are many, many people engaged in that endeavour.
Yeah.
So you share that journey with some fantastic people.
Heather Rabatz, Dame Commander, full of quotes, full of lessons. It was rich, really rich. So
well,
I really appreciate you coming on. It was a joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed this conversation. For my newsletter called A New Way of Being, head to simonmundy.com.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.